And our next case for argument is Ford versus Johnson. Mr. Ramsey.
May it please the court. My name is Doug Ramsey and I represent the plaintiff appellants in this matter. This matter comes before you on appeal from the district court's dismissal of Mr. Ford's amended complaint. The district court determined that Mr. Ford's excessive force claim should be dismissed with prejudice and his medical grievance claim should be dismissed without prejudice under section 1997 EA of the PLRA. We believe that the district court's opinion is wrong for a variety of reasons that are articulated in our briefs. I'd like to spend this morning talking about three issues which are of particular interest. The first issue is whether the district court improperly dismissed the excessive force claim with prejudice. The second issue really deals with whether Mr. Ford exhausted administrative remedies under the PLRA. Regardless of whether this court determines that Mr. Ford exhausted his administrative remedies, we believe that the district court erred by dismissing his excessive force claim with prejudice. Courts in the circuit and from around the nation have determined that the failure to exhaust administrative remedies is a temporary, curable procedural flaw, and that in circumstances when you can actually cure the exhaustion requirement, in the event that a litigant files a complaint before doing so, that the dismissal should be without prejudice, allowing the prisoner the opportunity to exhaust his remedies. That was not done here by the district court. And in fact, as we'll get into soon, by the time the district court entered its dismissal order, whatever procedural defect may have been apparent from the time he lodged his complaint had in fact been cured. So at the very outset, we believe that the case should be remanded to the district court so that with an instruction that the case, his excessive force claim, should be dismissed without prejudice. I'd like to turn into whether Mr. Ford,
what difference would it make if the excessive force claim were dismissed without prejudice? Is there time to file it anew?
We believe
time less than the statute of limitations.
We believe that the statute of limitations was stayed pending the litigation of the case, and we believe that he would have the opportunity
to... I don't understand that. If a claim is dismissed without prejudice, it's just gone. It doesn't stay. There's no staying or tolling effect on the statute of limitations.
Well, in effect, the district court had said that his excessive force...
So let's get back to my question. Would there be time left to file a new complaint measured from the time of the incident?
Measured from the time of the incident, no, there would not be. Neither would there be from the time that the administrative hearing was, the final determination was made. I'd like to now talk about the issue that really is at the heart of this matter, and that is whether Mr. Ford, in fact, exhausted his administrative remedies. The first issue
Let's
that...
Let's assume he did, eventually. Part of the problem in this case is that the lawsuit was filed before the ARB made its decision.
Well, in fact, we believe that...
Isn't that pretty much fatal?
In fact, we do not believe that it was filed before the final determination.
Let's put it this way. The opinion was tendered to the clerk of the district court before the ARB made its decision. Of course, the statute doesn't say suit shan't be filed. It says an action shall not be brought.
That is correct. In the way that
one would think an action is brought by sending the complaint to the district clerk.
Well, in fact, there's no case that has been cited that has interpreted shall be brought in this particular context. However, there are cases that have considered Section 1997 and have determined that shall be brought really refers to the filing of the complaint. In fact, if you refer to Rule 3...
What case holds that the word brought means the same as filed?
Well, again,
your brief points out cases, at least some opinions have used them interchangeably, to which the other side says, yes, but this issue was not being litigated there. Was this issue litigated in any of those cases?
There's not a single case that I've been able to find that deals with particular issues.
So no court has held that they're the same.
They have, if they've used them loosely in that context, then maybe that's perhaps...
People often use words loosely when nothing turns on the distinction. Well, here something turns on the distinction, so we need to pin it down.
I understand. Maybe we can pin it down by looking at Rule 3 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which says that a case is not, in fact, commenced until a complaint is filed. And I think if you determine when a case is actually filed under the Seventh Circuit and according to the Northern District of Illinois...
Look, the question is not when was this suit filed in a technical filing sense. The legal question is there a difference between the language of this statute? That is, does the word brought mean filed? Right? And that's what you need to argue.
And thank you, Your Honor. And in fact, as Your Honor pointed out, there are no cases which have come out.
Okay, so what's the reason for interpreting it your way?
If we determine shall be brought is the equivalent of filed, we think that there
What's the reason? What's the reason?
Because I think what we want to do is make this not an administrative procedure where a prisoner will submit, lodge his complaint with the district court, and then have the clerk's office actually become the administer of when a complaint is deemed filed, when a complaint is deemed received. I think that...
No, look, we're not asking who's deciding when something is filed. We're asking whether filed and brought mean the same thing.
Is there a policy reason for it?
Let me tell you why one might care when the complaint is tendered to the district clerk, no matter when he pays the filing fee. One reason for caring might be exactly what happened here. When he's called before the ARB, he says, I don't have to deal with you, I'm already in litigation. And it was to avoid that very kind of thing that Congress said, first exhaust, then sue. And if prisoners, once they mail the complaint off to the clerk, think that they're in litigation and stop cooperating, that's a serious worry, and that suggests we should treat the word brought as when you send the complaint to the clerk. Right? Anything wrong with that?
In this case, I think there is, and this really kind of gets into the second issue as to whether his administrative remedies should be deemed exhausted at the time he lodged
his complaint. Let's not get to the second issue until we figure out what the word brought means.
Sure. Although I have a feeling that I'm not able to point to a case that does that.
But now you can't point to a case.
Right.
Give a reason.
Is there a
right?
reason why paying the docket fee rather than sending the document to the district clerk should be treated as the time at which the complaint is brought?
I think that only following the authorities that I've cited in the
it's not authorities, right?
We've
appeals
already
are much
authority.
More interesting when there are no cases. Then you have to actually think instead of just reciting.
Sure. I'm not sure I can articulate a reason then for that, other than I think that's what the legislature intended by using the word brought as opposed
no,
to, for example, using the word...
It's going in circles.
An example the defense
Look,
relies on...
If you can't think of an affirmative reason of your own, how about addressing the reason I just gave? A reason for viewing brought as when you send the complaint in is that it may lead prisoners to stop cooperating, and that will gum up the administrative process. Is that a good reason, a bad reason, or an indifferent reason? This is your opportunity to address it.
That's the whole purpose for the PLRA, is to stop the gumming up of the process, and I think under that scenario, it would not be beneficial in order to consider brought, meaning something separately from filed, as opposed to...
Oddly, and the reason I asked you, I was hoping you'd amplify what you actually gave a reason in your brief. I may have forgotten it, but on page 21, you said authorizing the commencement of the district court action without the required fee would breed countless administrative and procedural woes and give the clerk's office an element of discretion where none was intended. The clerk's office would be converted into a part-time credit institution, spending significant energy collecting fees as well as extending credits.
I may have not been terribly clear. I thought that was an issue that I had in fact raised a little bit earlier in the fact that it would burden the system.
But isn't this your reason for... Isn't this your reason for why you want to interpret brought to mean filed?
Indeed it is.
Okay.
Well, but why? If we view brought as meaning whenever you send your complaint in, how does this have anything to do with credit?
Well, I think that does then further the purpose of the PLRA.
No, how does it have anything to do with district clerks extending credit or anything like that?
I think what it has to do with is the administrative burden that that then puts on the district court system.
What burden? What is the difference in the burden on district clerks? District clerks already have to see if they can get the fee collected. What difference in that burden is caused by one or another reading of the word brought?
Because I think then the administrators in the district court office become something more than what they're intended to be, and that's they're making decisions with respect to...
What could you articulate how the district clerk will behave differently if one reading of the word brought is given versus another?
I'm afraid I'll have to rely on what we've articulated in our briefs.
What's the burden you were referring to?
Well, the burden, again, you know, the PLRA is talking about the burden on the system in general. And I think that the burden that we're talking about as well is not only the burden that are on judges, but also on the administration of cases through the system. And the burden that I've just been commenting on is the burden that would be placed on the administration.
What's the difference, though, between just marking it received and filing it when it's viewed?
Well, because then if you mark it filed at the time it's actually received, which, again, is contrary to
there's nothing about marking it filed, right? You're now back to the equation of filing and brought. Suppose the word brought is interpreted to mean something different from the word filed. What exactly extra will that require the district clerk to do?
See, we're talking about the timing of exhaustion, not the actual documents received by the clerk, but when you have to exhaust. So the question is whether you can exhaust after you've, you know, submitted your complaint, sent your complaint to the clerk's office, you have to do it before. Are there implications for district court clerk workload in that judgment?
I think in that case there may, because they then become, again, what they're doing is they're actually marking it filed, and I think they become the...
No, they wouldn't mark it filed. They just wouldn't.
Okay.
Right?
I can see that I'm not convincing...
It's filed later. The question is whether you have to exhaust before it's filed or before it's sent, which comes earlier, right?
It does.
So that's the only question. When do you have to exhaust? So what does that have to do with the clerk's office?
Only that the clerk's office is the office that really administers these cases.
Do you think the clerk makes a judgment on whether it's filed or received?
In fact, they do make the judgment because if they don't receive a fee, then it's only marked received under that circumstance.
But how is that different from any other case? And how is that difficult, whether a fee accompanies it or doesn't?
Well, the difficulty comes in is whenever you equate... brought with something else other than filed, because then the district clerk's office, again, it becomes, you know, repository for money and has to have a separate level of administration to the case.
What is the district clerk doing differently? On one possible reading of the statute, the action is brought when the district clerk stamps received on it. On another reading of the statute, the action is brought when the district court stamps the word filed on it. In choosing between those two readings of the statute, does that choice affect the behavior of the district clerk in any way? And if so, how?
Only in the sense that I can imagine, which is just the administration of the...
No, I think that's a deep confusion here. Look, there might be a debate over whether a statute of limitations starts to run when you file a suit or when you... statute of limitations starts to run when you're injured or when you discover the identity of the defendant, something like that. So the question when the statute starts to run doesn't have anything to do with the clerk's office. The suit comes in at the same time. The question is it time barred or not? That depends on what the accrual rule is. Well, similarly here, everything is the same in the clerk's office. The only question is the exhaustion defense good or bad, which depends on whether you have to exhaust before you send in your complaint, or you can wait until the fee has been paid and the complaint has been filed in. So the clerk would be oblivious, right, of this issue. The clerk don't deal with exhaustion issues, right?
No, indeed they do not.
And then they wouldn't care. That happens outside their domain. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Ms. Wonder?
Good morning, Your Honor. So this case requires the court to decide whether the action was brought upon the lodging of the complaint with the district court or subsequently when the complaint was stamped filed after the fees were paid, and taking the view that the lodging was the operative date, the complaint was brought upon lodging, is the view that is consistent with the language and the purposes of the PLRA. The PLRA doesn't define brought, but we know from the dictionary that brought is...
Let's not worry about the dictionary. Do you have a practical reason for one
Absolutely.
Date rather than the other?
Absolutely. That any other reading besides treating brought as meaning lodging would completely undercut the Congress's intent in making this a mandatory exhaustion requirement. The whole point is that in the big picture, judicial burdens will be reduced by requiring the administrative process to first run its course. And if an action is only brought down the road...
How concretely, what's the linkage in your view?
I'm sorry, the linkage?
Yeah, what's the linkage?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
What is the mechanism by which this adverse effect is realized?
Because significant judicial resources would be expended in these early stages.
Well, I don't understand that.
Well, the court at the early stages still has
the same question as to Mr. Ramsey. The exhaustion, just you know, whether it's a good defense or not. How you could exhaust earlier, you could exhaust later.
Well, exhaustion is a precondition.
No, that's the conclusion. But the question is, what difference is it going to make to anybody whether you have to exhaust before you actually send the complaint in, or you can wait until you've paid your fee to exhaust?
Since the purpose of the PLA in the large picture is to avoid these additional burdens on judicial
What's
resources.
What's the additional burden?
The additional burdens on judicial resources are
what
significant
do you think of Judge
Easterbrook's position
about what happens in between the time it's brought, if that doesn't mean filed, and when it's actually filed.
The judicial resources that are used at that stage are all the resources that are involved in assessing the fees.
The rationale I suggest has nothing whatsoever to do with judicial resources.
I realize that, and your rationale is another reason. I was attempting to address Judge Posner's question about what resources, which I understood to be what resources are expended in these early phases.
The question is, what reason do you have? What practical considerations do you have for wanting the word brought interpreted to mean lodged as opposed to filed? On the table.
The rationale that you gave of wanting cooperation from prisoners and not wanting them to jump the gun and to say, oh, this is already in court, don't have to cooperate with you.
Is it Illinois' experience that this is a common response? Do we know in some way whether prisoners stop cooperating when they think that the litigation is ongoing?
Empirically, we do not. How often that might induce a failure to cooperate.
This kind of rationale is a common one. If you think about the Federal Tort Claims Act, you have to exhaust your administrative remedies before bringing an FTCA suit. And the reason that's usually given is that will promote cooperation in the administrative process. But I don't know whether anybody has ever established whether that reason is true or is just phony baloney or, you know, urban legend or something like that.
But could I also say that those are the reasons that Congress has made that judgment as a policy determination by requiring this to be a precondition to suit?
Don't say Congress has made that judgment. Congress didn't define the word brought.
Correct.
It's a word that requires definition precisely because it could mean different things. Now, let me come back to my question. Do you know of any data that would help to understand whether this kind of belief that early filing interferes with the administrative process is true or just an urban legend?
I do not know of data on how many particular cases a prisoner may specifically stop cooperating.
These kinds of statutes are quite common. Not only the Tort Claims Act and here, almost all the environmental laws are now worded this way. You can't commence civil litigation until something has happened. You'd think there'd be one or more empirical studies by now about the effect of these rules.
We do know that the very lodging of the complaint creates some burden on the judicial system when that burden could have been obviated depending on the result of the administrative process.
If we say it's filed, though, that there's no burden. That's it.
If the administrative process had...
Your point must be that occasionally, once in a blue moon, the prisoner will actually get satisfaction in the administrative process and therefore won't send his complaint in, right? So the clerk's office will be spared the bother in that minute fraction of cases in which exhaustion actually satisfies the prisoner.
I think that argument looks to the big picture. Overall...
One second. That's what you... Forget the big picture, for God's sake. That's what you're saying, right? What I just said. That's the concrete consequence for the caseload system. The number of cases that are removed by successful exhaustion. I mean, successful in the sense you actually got what you wanted from the prison and you didn't have to send something to a clerk's office. So fewer pieces of paper are received by the clerk's office if the exhaustion has to precede the lodging.
That's one of the reasons motivating the PLRA, yes.
Oh, I can't think of any other.
We have guidance from the PLRA.
I'm not saying it's a bad reason. It's a perfectly minor reason. On the other hand, it's hard to see what's on the other side, so...
We're trying to tick off what we have.
Pardon?
I'm just trying to tick off what we have. We have the purposes of the PLRA.
I don't get anything out of that general stuff, really.
How about this one? The design of the PLRA as a whole uses the word, I know I'm not really looking at filing here, we're looking at brought, but I still think it's instructive that when filing is referred to in the PLRA, it's in a sense of lodged. And we can see that from the amendments to Section 1915, which concern IFP proceedings, and they require a court to assess an initial filing fee by looking at a prisoner's trust account in the 6 months before the filing of the complaint. And obviously, if that meant that the statute required courts to determine what fee to charge by looking at the 6 months after the fee was paid, that wouldn't make sense. So within the design of the PLRA, when we're talking about, well, what is filing, there's a contemplation that filing is lodging, which is another reason in support of why brought here should really be the very beginning, the invocation of the judicial process. Other reasons that support that there's an analogy here. I think we do have some guidance from the United States Supreme Court.
To call it the invocation of the judicial process is a little bit odd. You don't actually invoke in the sense of requiring a court to do something until you've paid your fee.
I'm taking the term from a United States Supreme Court case, which I think is instructive here, that construes a statute in the Federal Tort Claims Act that says an action shall not be instituted. And when I was talking about the dictionary earlier, I referred to the dictionary because brought and instituted are synonymous.
No, but look, there is a difference. That is, when you file a complaint, you do invoke judicial action. The court has a duty, to look at the complaint and so on. But when you just lodge it, You're not asking the court to do anything at all.
Well, you are asking the court to do something, because upon a lodging, the court has to go through the assessment of the fees, has to go through the whole process of deciding what the initial fee should be, and under the statute, under the PLRA, the duty to, I don't know if this happens as a practical matter, but under the statute, the time frame for assessing, for doing the screening process of taking out claims that are malicious or frivolous or fail to state a claim is triggered whenever, before docketing whatever feasible, otherwise after docketing. So the screening duties under the statute start upon lodging, even if as a practical matter the court might perform that later. So significant judicial resources can be expended in these early stages.
Do you have a response to Judge Easterbrook's question of Mr. Ramsey about the significance or insignificance of dismissing the excessive force claim without prejudice?
You're asking me that question. Yeah. You referred to Mr. Ramsey.
Well, I'm sorry. It was Judge Easterbrook's question.
Would there be time to refile it? If it were dismissed without prejudice, could it be timely refiled now?
If it were dismissed without prejudice?
Yes.
If it were dismissed without prejudice, it could not be timely refiled now. The statute of limitations would have run. There was some issue about whether this should have been a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice.
Would he have an equitable tolling argument that his case is dismissed with prejudice? So, you know, there's no question.
He could have filed during that period.
You
could bring that up if you tried to file a new suit now.
That was erroneous, and it should have been without prejudice. Now, would that be the circumstances in which the statute of limitations would be told on the theory? You know, he didn't have reason to think that he would have an opportunity for refiling because it had been dismissed with prejudice.
If the dismissal with prejudice was erroneous,
right,
that may well affect the statute of limitations.
Okay, let me come back. I needed to rephrase my question then. It's obvious. If the district court on the actual day of the final judgment in this case had said the excessive force claim is dismissed without prejudice, had said that on that day, would there have been time remaining in the period of limitations on that day to file a new suit?
Bear with me a second. I'm trying to see when the final decision occurred in this case. Possibly not under, if it is in fact the 2-year statute of limitations that applies, since this would be a sort of a excessive force claim, a sort of tort type sketch of limitations borrowed from Illinois law. But I'm not entirely sure of whether time would have remained under the relevant statute of limitations if the complaint had been dismissed without prejudice at the time it was dismissed. There is an issue here of whether the dismissal should have been with prejudice, without prejudice, which turns to some extent on the reasons for the dismissal. Here the court thought there was some abandonment of the process. That's why it dismissed it with prejudice. Ordinarily, a premature filing is not a dismissal with prejudice. However, this was also not the first premature filing in the case.
No, if there's a failure to cooperate, that would be a ground for dismissal with prejudice. We had a case recently involving that.
The other issues were raised as to whether administrative remedies became unavailable here to Mr. Ford through administrative delay. I'm prepared to just refer to the briefs there, since that issue hadn't been discussed at argument. If the court has any questions about that or any other questions about the case, I'm happy to answer those.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wonder.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramsey, how much time does he have? No time? You want a minute to rebut?
Briefly, in response to Judge Easterbrook's question as to whether they would have additional time had a case been dismissed without prejudice originally, the district court opinion was on September 28th of 2001. The administrative decision was on December 30th of 1999. Therefore, they would have had until December 30th of 2001.
Well, the time doesn't start with the administrative decision. It starts with the tortious behavior. We've held that the time pursuing the administrative remedies is excluded, right? But it's not the case that the 2 years starts with the administrative decision.
It's my understanding that it's told during the decision.
Exactly. The time starts with the injury, is told during the administrative process, and recommences at the end of the administrative process. So unless Ford commenced the administrative process within 2 days of the injury, it looks like he's probably out of time, even when the district court makes its original decision.
So, unless there are questions by the
panel. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Ramsey, and Ms. Wunder.